Hello, and welcome to the Thinking Fellows podcast. My name is Scott Keith. I'm here today with Dr. Rod Rosenblatt and Adam Francisco. Caleb is out today. He's got the plague going around his family, and so he won't be here for the next couple episodes. We are continuing on our timeline, heading through the Reformation. We left off at the Augsburg Confession last time around, which is around 1530. And so we'll pick up at 1530, hit some of the major events that go on in the 1530s over the next couple of episodes, and we thank you for joining us. The Thinking Fellows is part of the 1517 Podcast Network. If you'd like to know anything more about 1517, you can check us out at 1517.org. That's 1517.org. There you can find all about our podcasts, our blog sites, our publishing house, our conferences. Also, if you'd like to support the work of the Gospel Proclamation at 1517, you'll find a donate button on that same page. Check us out there at 1517.org. All right, 1530-ish. It's been an interesting trip through the Reformation. I feel kind of weird doing this without Caleb leading us down a path, so we'll see how this goes today. And also, I was instructed to let the listeners know that there is some construction going on, not at our house this time, but a couple doors down. So you might hear that in the background. There's really nothing we can do about it. 1530, we've just come out of the Diet of Augsburg, right? That happens in June 25th of 1530. The Confutation, the response to the Augsburg Confession, is presented on August 3rd of that same year. It's an interesting document, right? It's an interesting time period. I recorded an academy course on the Augsburg Confession, and we didn't have too much time in that course to spend on the history. We did mostly the theology of the Augsburg Confession. But I did point out in the introduction to that there's so much sort of preparation and thought that goes into the writing of the Augsburg Confession, where the Lutherans thought they'd finally have their chance to present their positive case.
Yep.
The chance that they'd been waiting for since, you know, probably around 1520, 1521, for a decade is leading up to this moment. And they're so into it that they even produce a couple of practice documents, the Schwabach articles and the Marburg and Torgau articles. I mean, they just lead up to it. And by the time they get there, they present 28 positive articles of faith that Melanchthon has labored over and sent copies and revisions and drafts to Luther and others to look over, and they present it, and it's as if the Roman theologians there, as if they didn't even read it, you know, or hear its presentation, yeah, or consider it, because they sort of automatically just dismiss it out of hand, which was so confusing to the, we'll just call them Lutherans assembled at the time, because Melanchthon had done a lot of work to connect what they said they confessed and believed, and connect that to the beliefs and the confession of the church for 1,500 years previous to this time. And for it to just be rejected kind of out of hand was very confusing to them. I mean, they connected what they were saying to Scripture. They connected it to the church fathers.
Yep.
And they were at a loss.
I know this is a little off script, but it's still relevant. In 1530, just looking at Luther, he becomes extremely pessimistic. So pessimistic that he's going to begin associating I think last episode we mentioned the Ottoman Turks making their way to Vienna in 1529, just short of the Diet of Augsburg. And he'll write something shortly after the Diet of Augsburg called An Army Sermon Against the Turk, where he associates Daniel chapter 7 with the events that are unfolding in his day and age.
End times are here.
Yeah, the image of this great beast that comes out of the sea, and it's got 10 horns on its head, and then a little one pops up and displaces three. For him, that's that just precedes the coming of the Ancient of Days, and that he associates that little horn that pops up with the Ottoman Empire. So he thinks the world is coming to an end. There's in the Table Talk, which aren't exactly always the most reliable sources for Luther, they're basically things that his students recorded when they're drinking beer or in lectures and things like that. There's a report that he wrote on the wall as they're hanging out the year 1600 and said, we probably won't, the world won't last this long.
Yeah.
So, oh, wow. Yeah, his pessimism is, of course, you know, with the Turks, but also just the way that the Church of Rome was treating the restored gospel.
Yep.
Yeah, so it was, that's really interesting, and it's kind of telling. At the end of the day, what the Roman theologians present in August is something called the Confutation, which is, by all accounts, a hastily prepared response to the careful work of Melanchthon and the Lutheran theologians.
And I think you mentioned last time, this is in the, I think it's the sources for the Book of Concord, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah.
And you read that, it's been some time, but like you said just a bit ago, it's almost like they didn't even read the Oxford.
No, like,
they're arguing against air.
Yeah, that's right. They're not. The Confutation is written in such a way that you can't even sort of draw a one-to-one argument against particular articles of the Augsburg Confession as you go through the Confutation.
Mm-hmm.
And by all accounts, it's hastily prepared, so much so that it really, the Confutation itself really ticks off Melanchthon, just because it seems like he put in all that work for nothing. One of the things that I said in the Academy lecture is that it's important to know that the Augsburg Confession was a confession that was prepared for the whole Christian church.
Yes, that's really important to know.
Yeah. It wasn't just a Lutheran confession by a long shot.
Yeah, think opposite of sect.
Yeah.
Could we call it small c Catholic?
Yeah, and I did.
Universal, ecumenical.
Yes. Mm-hmm. That was the intent.
But the apology, which he publishes in 1531, late 1530, early 1531, Melanchthon is commissioned to write that. And so it's much more so than the Augsburg Confession, a work that Melanchthon prepares on his own. And you can see that because it's sort of like, you read the Augustana, it's a confession, right? It's the articles are brief on the whole. They follow a very discernible order, making an argument from the need for justification to justification kind of as a sinner, and then how the life in the church works out after that through word and sacrament. And the apology does the same thing, but the reins are off at this point. It's much longer.
Yeah, they tried polite.
They tried polite.
And when polite got treated so badly, they uncorked.
Yeah. And he's commissioned to do this, and he writes a response, and it's a damning response because it's so thoroughly written and so well done that there's really not much that's left to be said concerning what do the Lutherans believe now. And I'd say much more so the apology is very much a Lutheran confession.
Yes.
So. Yeah.
And it's remarkable.
And it's remarkable.
It is.
Yeah.
Bill Swirlo once said years ago in class that if there's one thing to read every year, it's Article 4 of the Apology on Justification.
Remember, apology is being used in the sense of not apologizing to Rome, but in the sense of defense, like in the word apologetics. It's not saying I'm sorry. It's a reasoned defense. And in this case, they thought, we're going to give it a reasoned defense because the polite overall short didn't have any effect whatever.
So I was just in Dallas, Texas, and I helped Kelsey Klimbera translate a letter that Melanchthon sent to Brenz in 1531 or 1532. I'm not quite sure. And three times in this brief letter, he refers to his apologia.
Uh-huh.
Now, sometimes with Melanchthon, it's hard to tell if he's referring to the Augustana, the Augsburg Confession, when he says that, or the apology, because he uses those the same way sometimes. I mean, as he's preparing the Augustana, the Augsburg Confession, he calls it their defense. And so it's difficult. But it's very easy to see in the apology that what he's presenting is a defense. This is now a formal defense of what we teach at Wittenberg. Period. And it's, like Adam said, it's wonderful. But I did want to say, and have Adam speak to this a little bit. I mean, again, we need to reiterate that as they gather at the Diet of Augsburg in 1530, this is as much a political gathering as it is a theological gathering. Mm-hmm. Probably more so a political.
Primarily political
gathering.
For the sake of the unity of Europe, for the common defense against the expansion of the Ottoman Muslim Empire deep into Central Europe. Even in late in 1529, after the Battle of Vienna, around the time of, it's usually called the Siege of Vienna, actually, Turkish sorties make their way into Germany, into Bavaria, and scare the willies out of the Germans. Because, you know, communication's slow, right?
Yes.
They are thinking that Vienna's fallen, and then the rest of Europe is going to fall in its wake. So it's a time, if you, in looking at, if you look at the history of printing in these times, I don't know what the percentage would be, but a good bulk of the material printed after 1529 is dealing with the threat of the Ottomans and the necessity for European unity, or the unity of Christendom. Otherwise, everybody's projecting, from Catholic to Anabaptist to Lutheran, that the Turks are just going to stroll right in. They were,
and it looked
at
bad.
That point, unstoppable. Yeah, I mean, the Sultan of the Ottoman Empire was Suleiman. Europeans called him the Magnificent because he was so good at what he did, that his empire building. Also, this is way off script, but that same year, there's an interesting table talk where Luther is sitting there at the table and he hears from somebody who knows an ambassador, a Habsburg ambassador to the Turks, who sends word to Luther that says, Sultan Suleiman says that if you will side with the Turks, you know, lend your support to the Turks and kind of adopt the Anabaptist line that just let the Turks come in, it's better to be ruled by the Turk than the Pope, the Sultan will treat you as a gracious lord.
Oh, wow.
And Luther gives the proverbial hand gesture to that and says, God, help me from this gracious lord. But a little more political background, not too long ago, there was a document discovered in the Ottoman archives of a spy report, a Turkish spy report that was surveying all the things going on in Europe in the late 1520s, and then sent that brief to the Sultan and said, right now is the ideal time to attack because Europe is so disunited because of this monk, Martin Luther.
Oh, that's amazing.
In Arabic script, first time his name appears in Arabic script, it's Turkish language, but so right now is the time to attack. Because Martin Luther has challenged the Pope, and he's taken a whole bunch of Germans with him.
Wow.
And I mean, it's a real 1529, 1530, and 15 up to about 1532.
Politically
is really
tumultuous.
Exciting. All the theology.
It's kind of a footnote to that.
Well, in a way, I'm trying to think of the name, but there's a great book, Martin Luther's Theology, Bernard Loza.
Yes.
Where he says the history of especially the early Reformation, the Lutheran Reformation in particular, cannot be understood adequately, historically speaking, if you don't know about the political circumstances, especially the politics between the Habsburgs and the Ottomans.
Well, that's interesting.
So much of what Luther writes in these days, even the 95 Theses or his explanation to the 95 Theses, includes references to the Turks.
There's
popes are cajoling for the Crusade. Luther's addressing these sorts of things. So, I mean, the theology is remarkable, but there's an even more fantastic historical, political story going on in the background.
Well, that leads me into what I was going to ask you, is that, so the Augsburg Confessions presented, princes and electors and mayors and what we'd call governors sign it, saying, this is our confession. We want to be unified with us, but this is our unified confession. Yeah. And that's denied, which means that the purpose for the political gathering at the Diet of Augsburg is sort of null and void at this point, because they don't actually become a unified front. Mm-hmm. All of these political leaders have signed this the statement that ends up being rejected. And in 1531, those same leaders essentially form what's called the Small Caldic League, which is, what's the Small Caldic League, Adam?
Well, in short, it's to defend the protesting territories, the Lutheran territories, but also it's a military alliance, basically, right? To political alliance to defend the integrity of the Lutheran Reformation, the physical security of the Lutherans in northern Germany, primarily, and also, though, with a view towards defending that territory against any sort of Ottoman incursions. So I know there's a lot more going on there, but that's
the twofold purpose, right? Yeah. So the initial forming of the Small Caldic League is this diet breaks down, which they wanted to be a council anyway, right? Mm-hmm. So no council, you get a diet breaks down, there's no real resolution. there's the real threat that the emperor and the Roman, you know, the Roman church essentially will come up and take over this land, these evangelical lands again. So they form the small Catholic League. But the secondary benefit really is that if the Turks end up coming into their territory, they have an army then too.
Yeah. There is, I mean, there's some historical minutia too. There were talks, nothing real serious about the possibility of not allying themselves with the Turk as a real ally, but based on the principle, the enemy of my enemy is my friend, perhaps temporarily, gaining some, some sort of, check against Turkish incursions into their territory.
Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah. A couple other not-so-minor events, but events that happen in this timeline is Ulrich Zwingli dies,
In the Battle of Kapelle.
For 31, which we talked about last time. And then I thought this is interesting. 1532, John Steadfast dies. Yeah. And John Steadfast is
his great defender.
Is the elector. Essentially, I mean, we say elector. We've explained it a couple times. It might be worth you explaining again what an elector is, Adam. But he's essentially Luther's prince, the ruler.
A confessing Roman Catholic from beginning to end.
Luther's ruler of time. He's the one that founded the University of Wittenberg. He's the one that pays, really, for the University of Wittenberg. Makes a lot of decisions about it. Even I read a letter at one point where Luther goes and argues to John the Steadfast that Melanchthon ought to have a double salary for teaching Greek and theology. What a friend to have.
Yeah.
The best kind. You meant this term elector. So there are princes all throughout Europe, right? Basically, a prince is just the leading citizen, if you will. But there are some that are electors in Germany. And what that means is they're responsible for example, if Charles V died or decided to, as he did, leave office a couple decades later, they are the ones who vote on or negotiate who the next emperor would be.
Well, there aren't that many of them.
Correct.
Is seven or eight?
Yeah, there's seven. I think it differs over time, but seven in the 16th.
Yeah,
the 16th century, and so it was not, they're pretty powerful in terms of at least the nominal authority in the Holy Roman Empire of the German nation. So pretty significant. So you always want to keep the Saxon elector on your side if you're Charles or if you're the Holy Roman Emperor. So I think that in many ways, so there's an old thesis. I think it's been mentioned before that the distraction that the Turks provided for both the Roman Emperor, the Holy Roman Emperor, and also the Bishop of Rome or the Pope, in many ways contributed to the success of the Protestant Reformation. But also, you cannot underestimate the influence of the elector, the guy who protected Luther from right after the Diet of Worms and had him kidnapped and secreted away.
That was all his prince that did that, and without asking Luther, Luther was taken by surprise by it. Yeah. But his elector was looking out for him when Luther wasn't.
Well, and maintains that protection.
Yep.
And sort of the heritage of protecting Luther, though, passes down to the electors that follow.
Yeah, and the interesting thing is you Luther is always going to be sort of, be protected, but then he's going to be a major source that the elector will, usually using George Spalatin as a secretary to consult with Luther on matters. Like Luther will be asked, is it wise to maybe heed the call of the Pope to go on a crusade against the Turk? Or he'll even be involved in real estate disputes.
When he has a major sort of opinion, his opinion is taken into account on the bigamy of Philip of Hesse. Even on a
that
sort of
is a really interesting. I wish we could pursue that, but the bigamy of Philip of Hesse, he did not excommunicate him. He went to talk to him and basically said, Philip, you got to have one wife or no wives, but you can't have two. But look at the attitude in that.
Yeah.
Who would want two?
No.
Or who would want two husbands?
Right.
Could say.
But still, so many in our own group would say,
he's out.
Yep.
Yeah.
And that wasn't Luther.
Yeah.
No, but well, both he and Melanchthon were both consulted, and they both saw it as a difficult case. And I think one of the, I could be wrong here, but I thinking back, one of the sort of things that pushed them over the edge as to this is not a good thing overall, was everything that had gone on with Henry VIII by that point. And that,
They refused to acknowledge an annulment to Catherine of Aragon.
Yep.
And they seem a bit, it's much more complicated than just saying they're contradicting themselves with
Philip
of Hesse. But
yeah, I read a couple of letters years ago where this was really thought about by both Luther and Melanchthon and kind of debated too. Because I learned this from Lowell Green years and years ago, that there's no Christian admonition for a man only to have one wife. That this is Roman law that Christianity had incorporated into sort of its edicts and teachings for years and years and years. The only admonition that we can find in the New Testament is that a pastor ought to only have one wife, but not that, you know, that you literally can't have more than one wife.
Very interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I remember Lowell Green taught that at Concordia in like 1997, and I heard that, and I'm newly married, and Now, years later, I'm like, no. Which is what Lowell said. He said, I can't imagine having two wives.
Yeah.
Anyway, we're probably getting in trouble.
Or two husbands,
yeah. We'll probably get in trouble for this episode of the podcast. And on that note, I mean, it is interesting to note that in 1533, of course, Henry VIII is excommunicated for divorcing his first wife, having it annulled. I don't remember which it is, but it seems like what goes on there is that doesn't he have to get special dispensation to marry her in the first place because she's the wife of his brother who died
related,
and so that he has to get special dispensation from the Pope to marry her in the first place, and so that he gives it, and then he's like, just kidding, I actually want to be married to this other lady, and the Pope's like, you gotta be kidding me, you know, I just bent over backwards so that you could marry her in the first place. When he does it anyway, essentially, and he's, by all accounts, he's carrying on with his second wife, Anne Boleyn, right? Mm-hmm, I get these wives.
Oh boy,
so
it's confusing.
I think he ends up with six of them.
Six total.
By the end of the
six
day?
Wives and
seriatim, one after the other.
Yeah. Carter Lindbergh, Boston University or Boston College, has this book, great book, European Reformations, plural. And in the English Reformation, he refers to Henry VIII. It's a great line. He says he was above all else, he was a sexual athlete. What is that?
Yeah.
How does one get in that league?
And, yeah.
He has six wives official, and some die. Like for example, Anne Boleyn die at complications of giving birth to Edward, who will replace Henry VIII when he dies in 1547. Some he has executed.
Luther.
Yeah. So it's complicated, but in 15, right after he's excommunicated, he issues what's called the Acts of Supremacy, where he declares himself the head and the head of the church in England, the Church of England, and also the defender of the faith.
Yeah.
And that marks the beginning of what some call the Heinrichian Reformation, which is oftentimes treated differently than, say, what's going on in the continent, because it's very much a top-down Reformation, whereas in the continent it's primarily from the bottom up.
Just sometimes it's called the English Reformation too, right?
Sure, yeah.
Which gets to be complicated too, because of all of sort of the eventual Calvinist influences in the North.
Yeah.
One of our guys, Steve Burns, said to me one time, he had studied with the Anglicans, and his comment was, there were only six who got it, the Reformation. There were only six who got it, and we burned them all.
Yeah, I mean, well, that happens, you know, that happens later, of course. I think eventually the Reformation on the continent is eventually bloody too, but sort of down the road, if that makes any sense. I mean, there are some like the Peasants Revolt and whatnot that make it bloody.
Sure, and some early Dominicans who were under Luther's influence who were burned in the Netherlands. But it does get bloody for the Lutherans and the Reformed later on.
But the English Reformation, that's a bloody event. I mean, from top down, that's a bloody event. And what Rod is referring to is, I don't know the year, but it's when Mary becomes
Queen of Scots.
No, Mary. No, Mary. Queen of Scots. That's a different Mary. Mary, the sister of Elizabeth and the daughter of Henry, when she becomes the Catholic queen,
right?
She has all of the sort of Protestant theologians that had mostly come up, some under Henry, but a lot of them under Edward, mm-hmm. had come to prominence.
Edward was really young, though. He was just sort of like the nominal king, if you will.
But under advisors, these theologians had come into more prominence and more power, and she has them. She has them killed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you can go to Oxford this day, right in the city center on the northern side. As you're passing, there's a big martyr, the Martyrs Memorial, and then as you're walking towards the Bodleian Library, I would say the best library in the world. There's some brickwork on the ground. Everything else is paved, which is just sort of not sort of normal asphalt. But then there's a little brick in the shape of a cross right by, I think it's Balliol College where Wycliffe was. And
it's right. It's almost across and just down the street from the bookstore, Blackwell's.
Correct. Yeah, which is right across from the Bodleian. And so you can go read the plaque on the wall there, and it's dedicated to the.
It's usually Riddler, there's usually Ridley, some beggar with a.
Oh, yeah.
Guitar sitting underneath it, you know, asking for
spare change.
Some shillings. But yeah. So this is all going. I mean, this is an interesting time. I was talking with Caleb today as we were. I mean, obviously, this episode's not as planned as some, but as we were quote unquote planning this episode. And the earlier episodes are easy in a sense because there's really monumental events going on. You know, from 1517 until 1530, fairly regularly. But then you have the Augsburg Confession. And after that, what you sort of have, there's a lot of stuff going on, but it's sort of now going on all over the place.
Yeah, that's right.
And it's, you know, you could spend several episodes just on Henry VIII and the English Reformation, right? You could spend several episodes probably just on the Apology if you really needed to or wanted to.
The line I remember, not being primarily an historian, the line that I remember was that when the reformers in England, the English reformers, came out with their first sort of suggestion or edict or plan, the reaction was almost instant. And they said, that's nothing but the Augsburg Confession.
Yeah.
And it was not a praise of it. It was critical.
Yeah. I've done some work with some students on looking at Cranmer and his theological writings, and you could see a lot of influence from, and again, we've said this on the show multiple times, arguing from influence is kind of dangerous. But you can see, I mean, similar phrases between the Augsburg Confession and other writings of Melanchthon. In fact, later on in England, Elizabeth is catechized using Melanchthon's Loci. And so
interesting.
In her reign, especially some of the theologians that are at work during her reign, you can definitely see some of that influence.
Well, we had Dr. Corey Moss on. This is going back when we were recording in the garage in St. Juan. And he did his dissertation on one of these English reformers, Robert Barnes, who executed in 1540, and he was a thoroughgoing Lutheran. And there's a Scottish man, Patrick Hamilton, around the same time. So it's long been a thesis, or at least some conjecture on the part of historians, of what would have happened had there not been this kind of weighty Reformed influence. Some speculate that England would have gone the way of Lutheranism. William Tyndale, for example, I once heard a paper where the author titled it, Was William Tyndale a Lutheran? And he concluded that there's a few things that are a little distinct to him, but primarily he was Lutheran.
Interesting. Now, I've read several times that early on, early 1530s, essentially, that under Henry, there was more of a chance for it to go Lutheran, except for the fact that Henry could not stand Luther.
Yep. Yeah, I've heard that too, yeah.
Yeah.
That's understandable.
He wanted Luther to give his approval to each marriage, and Luther didn't.
Well, it's kind of like getting two alpha males together in a room and just initially saying, hey, you guys like each other? I mean, automatically they're going to say, no, I can't stand that guy. And you kind of get that sense. I mean, Henry is boisterous and opinionated and speaks into everything, and Henry gets that same sort of vibe from Luther too, and is not attracted to it, but he is attracted to Melanchthon. We'll talk about this more.
To lengthen out to teach at, I think it's Cambridge.
Cambridge offers him the chair of theology at Cambridge.
Man, that would have been interesting. History would have unfolded very
We'll save that for next episode.
The American colonies.
Yeah. Crazy.
What would have happened there?
Two more things that before we end this one up that I think are important to mention. The first is that I wanted Adam to talk about. This is right around the time that Luther publishes, I guess, a tract, an admonition to prayer against the Turks. Yeah. So what's that?
I think that's 1532, if I'm not mistaken. Yep. That's a sort of the last of a series of things, pamphlets and books that he writes on the issue of the Ottoman Turks. And we've talked quite a bit about that. But the admonition to prayer against the Turks is a kind of an ecumenical appeal to every single Christian in Europe. In addition to all the military, political, polemical stuff that he's done, he appeals that first and foremost, Christians attend to their own house, get their own house in order, in particular by repenting of their rejection of the gospel, their gross sins, but especially to appeal to God. Because for Luther, behind all of history for Luther are the powers and principalities of darkness.
Sure.
And if Christendom is going to be saved, if this continent that where the gospel can freely be preached, sort of at this time, God has to God has to be the one who's going to protect Europe. And then Luther is not a theologian of glory. He doesn't think if they just do things right, God's going to grant them success. But he does think that history, in a large measure, unfolds because of God's approval or withdrawal.
They all think this.
Yeah.
At this point. Too. I mean, this is
common for over 1,000 years.
Yeah. This is why Melanchthon looks to the stars. He's not looking for the pagan powers in the stars to give him guidance. He thinks that if this stuff is true. And that God has both revealed himself in his word and in his creation, that one might be able to discern his plan from looking at the stars. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It's still hokey as heck, but...
Yeah, but these are pre-modern people, so to speak. Even as Christian as you might be right now, we can't help but... I mean, you have to admit there's been some sort of very modern influence on our worldview. To be pre-modern would be very... Really pre-modern. I mean, Luther has very much a late medieval worldview.
Sure.
A lot of stuff looks quirky to us.
Yeah.
One that I hope is pursued would be in the field of science. I'll just suggest it, that the Reformation really was the time when science was included, encouraged, praised. Mm-hmm. And so forth. And the historians of science who are purely secular, or it's a bone in their throat.
Yeah, yeah.
But it's still true.
Mm-hmm. You take a case, this is moving a decade after the 1530, or the time we've been looking at, but the Copernicus publication, 1543, right. I think.
Yeah.
Basically, people rejected him because it went against... the accepted view of things, and finally he goes to Wittenberg and has it published. And Luther says some weird things about it. He goes, this sounds weird, but he says, ideas that are based in fact should always be considered.
Yep. So he published it and others wouldn't.
Yeah.
Last thing for this episode, interesting, and I know Rod can talk about this a little bit. This is the same time period, 1534, when the Society of Jesus is founded, the Jesuits are founded.
For one purpose only. That's to eliminate the Reformation, and at its best, by outthinking them. It was founded to do just that one thing. Now, they weren't above doing it in...
Burning people.
Yes, but it's worth noting that during my day, they were the stormtroopers of Rome, the Jesuits. They've fallen far from that now.
Yeah, they're quite liberal.
Yeah, I mean, but
that's an understatement.
Back in my own lifetime, everybody knew what the Jesuit order was for. It was to eliminate the reformers and their thought, and primarily by outthinking them.
Well, their legacy is still, I'm sorry to cut
no,
you
go
off,
ahead.
But legacy is still around with most of the Catholic universities that are in cities with names like the name of the city, then university following are Jesuit universities. And they tend to be, while they're quite progressive and so on, they are certainly not dummies.
No.
Very, very rigorous scholarship.
You
know, St. Louis University, where I grew up, I met when I was toying with you, and thankfully you told me not to do it, toying with doing a PhD in philosophy.
Yep.
I met with a Jesuit priest
yep.
on the morning of September 11, 2001, and we had this conversation. We didn't know what was unfolding in the world around us,
sure.
and I was just blown away at, while the guy was very eclectic and I couldn't follow everything, but the guy, just his knowledge was encyclopedic.
Yep.
And then he learned I was Lutheran. Then all of a sudden the conversation changed a bit. Yeah. It wasn't polemical, but it was there was a polemical undercurrent.
Good thing you didn't do it.
Is there a sort of like a tacit acknowledgement in the founding of the Jesuits to counter the Reformation that the Reformation itself, at least I'll give credit to the Lutheran Reformation because we're still this early, to the Lutheran Reformation, that it is an intellectually based movement.
Yes.
And that needs to be countered.
We've talked about the document that came out so quickly after Augsburg,
right.
The Confutation.
Right.
This is a whole different approach than the Confutation.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And wasn't some of the goal of the Society of Jesus to retake the universities too?
Yeah, and they figured that they could.
Yeah, because Lutheranism was making inroads into universities, especially through Melanchthon's reform of universities, was making inroads into universities and is thus making inroads into teachers and pastors and thus making inroads into people in the congregations and students in schools and the whole nine yards.
A case could be made that the actual academic profession of historian begins with the Reformation because the Reformers needed to make sure they got their facts right in terms of where the church erred. That's Corey Moss has written an article on the rise of the profession of historian as we conceive of it now, that is describing things of the past as they actually happened with substantial, they didn't use footnoting back then, but substance behind it, not just assertions about the past. But
right.
And that starts with Luther in his trial, 1519, 15 to 1521, as he's consulting with others and doing his own homework. He knows he's got to get it right.
Yep.
And we've said this before, but for Luther, if there's one thing that we could say about him, and lots of things, but is he is especially interested in what is true. Hmm. So much so that he's always asking himself the question, am I the only one that's wise?
Yes.
Why is it I'm the only one that's seeing this?
Right. Because predictably, Rome's answer from the very, very beginning was, we have 800 exegetes who disagree with you, Luther.
I mean, never mind their exegeting Aquinas, but that's fine.
Well, But that, that's the sort of thing where anybody with any brains at all says, why am I the only one that...
Yeah.
Thinking this.
Yeah.
You're the one looking at the Bible, buddy. last thing I just want to end on, and I think this is often overlooked, is that the same year, and we'll pick up at 1535 at the next episode, because that's kind of a fun year. But 1534 is the first complete edition of Luther's German Bible is published.
Mm, yeah. Highly significant.
Highly significant and often overlooked. I mean,
he formed the German language.
Well, and taught the people to read
yeah.
so that they could read the Bible and the catechism, for Pete's sake.
Yeah.
I mean, I've looked over Melanchthon's curriculum developed for the grammar schools, and it is wholly centered on learning to read by means of learning to read Luther's German Bible and the Catechism. Uh-huh. I mean, it's so you have a whole nation and whole region, right? It's not even fair just to call it a singular nation, but region of the world that is taught to read. That's remarkable.
Yeah.
but taught to read so that they could read the Bible.
Yep.
And that they could read the Catechism.
Yep.
That's in these pre-literate cultures, I think that's the PC word to describe illiterate people. When missionaries go to work with them, the first thing they do is try to figure out how to write down their language and then translate the Bible into that language with the goal of getting the indigenous population to read the Bible. But with with the intent of also teaching them how to read and write to become a literate people. So that's that practice is still very, I mean, I don't know if it's particularly Lutheran anymore, but I certainly know it's the Lutheran's primary approach to especially unreached peoples who are not literate.
Interesting. All right, anything else before we close up the sort of early to mid-1530s?
Well, I'd say one person has to keep in mind, it's more forest than trees. The thing that characterized the Lutheran Reformation from its beginning was that it was Christocentric in a way that nobody else was.
That's funny that you say that, because I just sent Adam a document that I started working on last week that's intended to eventually help authors and contributors that we bring into 1517 know what 1517's about. Mm-hmm. And I think the first category I put is that it's ultimately Christological or ultimately Christocentric.
Yep.
And that's for that reason, is that you cannot understand at least what's going on within Lutheranism without grabbing hold of the fact that...
University background.
But one that on the basis of exegesis, got these men to a point where they really believed that the study and the teaching and the proclamation of theology was the proclamation of Christ Jesus.
Yep.
To the sinner, for the sinner.
Yep.
Period. And that drives this movement, the Lutheran movement. I struggle so much what to call it, but this Lutheran movement, in a way that even the reforms that come afterward are not driven in that same way or for that same reason or by that same mentality or motivation.
Yep. Dr. Kramer, back at our Springfield Seminary, used to refer to us as the epigones. And it was sort of an insult word, but it was a way of acknowledging just what you said.
Yeah. It's such an interesting in a marvelous way that, and then when you teach Lutheran theology, if you really have that as an organic part of you, it comes out in everything that you teach.
Absolutely.
I'm listening to, because I've been driving a lot, like I drove 5,000 miles in the last 3 weeks, 6,000 miles in the last 3 weeks.
In a big truck.
Then listening to 40 Minutes in the Old Testament with Chad Bird and Dan Price from Genesis 1 forward. And I've listened to 20 episodes and we're on Genesis 6. the thing that you get out of that from Chad and Dan, but Chad's just a master of it, is that you can't even, he's very Lutheran. Once that's become part of you, you can't see, you see everything in terms of Christ and you can't unsee it.
Yeah. Yeah.
And to hear somebody go, verse by verse through the Old Testament, this is where Christ is here. This is where Christ is here.
Yes.
This is where Christ is here.
Oh, wonderful.
Is
the late H.C. Leupold, the Old Testament scholar I studied with at one of the ALC seminaries, that same thing characterized him. And it was a long lineage. He wouldn't say it was original at all.
Yeah.
It was just what he absorbed early in life and was passing on to students of his.
That's amazing. All right. Well, that's it for this week. Thank you for tuning in to the Thinking Fellows podcast, of course, a podcast of the 1517 Network. If you'd like to support us, please go to 1517.org. That's 1517.org. And on that page, you'll find a donate button. Go ahead and hit that, and we appreciate your support. We cannot do this show or any of the other projects that we support over 1517 without your financial help, and we thank you for it. Thanks a lot, and we'll see you next time.